San Luis Obispo or Monterey counties, you can ask for that food bank, and we'll direct a portion of your contribution to help the efforts of the food banks. We've been doing this since 2008 and have had a profound ability to help their programs, and you can do that today. 549-8855 at the $52 level or higher. Of course, the more you pledge, the more meals your gift provides to hungry families.
And the full amount of your gift to KCBX will be tax deductible because all of your contribution supports the programs of local nonprofit organizations. So if you were to select a coffee mug or a sunshade, a portion of your contribution would not be tax deductible based on receiving that tangible item. But with the food bank, all of your contribution is tax deductible. So that's yet another benefit. And we want to make it clear that there is no time frame for selecting the food bank premium. We are focusing on it today. We're talking about it today. But if you make your pledge at any time throughout the drive, you can select the food bank premium, including online.
That's right.
549-8855. Call now.
Toll free 1-800-549-8855. Support for Democracy Now! Comes from listeners like you. It also comes from Johnson Framing Studio on Sueldo Street off Lower Higuera in San Luis Obispo. Gail Johnson has proudly provided underwriting support for Democracy Now! Since its first broadcast on KCBX. Support also comes from UCSB Arts and Lectures, presenting the young Cuban band Tiempo Libre. They'll be in concert at UCSB's Campbell Hall on Wednesday evening, October 23rd at 8 o'clock. Tickets are available at 893-3535. This is Public Radio KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo at 90.1 FM, KNBX HD1 San Ardo at 91.7 FM, and KSBX Santa Barbara at 89.5 FM. In Avila Beach, we're Translator K215 AH at 90.9 FM. We serve Cayucos and Northern Morro Bay at 91.1 FM. For the Santa Ynez Valley and the Cambria-San Simeon area, we are at 90.9 FM. And in the Lompoc-Vandenberg Village area, we are at 95.1 FM. The time is 2 minutes after 1 o'clock. It's time for Issues and Ideas here on KCBX. Call now 549-8855, 1-800-549-8855, or pledge online at kcbx.org.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm this week's host, Larry Rutter. Every time I've had the opportunity to host this program, I've been rewarded by meeting interesting people, often with unique ideas and perspectives. So this week, I thought it might be fun to revisit a few of the more interesting conversations we've had so far this year on Issues and Ideas. For instance, we often get visitors in town, very prominent and/or interesting people, and we like to snag a few of them into the KCBX studios. In a bit, we'll meet a group who were literally walking through town when we corralled them. One person who visited with us last year was last year's Teacher of the Year, Rebecca Milwaukee. In real life, she teaches middle school in Burbank, California. The past year, she has been touring the country speaking about teaching and education. One of her visits actually entailed a fist bump from President Obama at the White House. One of her other stops was to talk at the Clark Center in Arroyo Grande. In talking with her, we soon discovered why she was the National Teacher of the Year, as you will hear. Among other things, we asked her, what was the biggest challenge of being a teacher today?
The words that people hear the most are the achievement gap, which is the differing levels of achievement between, white middle-class Americans and everyone else who are struggling to maintain the same levels of academic achievement. And that was something that was kind of thrown around and talked about when I started teaching. But in those 15 years, I saw not only achievement gaps opening up, but I saw opportunity gaps for kids not getting access to music and arts and sports and field trips and hands-on learning opportunities. I saw love gaps, parents both busy at work and having to work a lot longer day and thus unable to be at home and providing that kind of a supportive environment for kids to learn and achieve at home, safe places to do homework, hot meals many times a day. So you saw kids now not only struggling to measure up to their peers academically, but now trying to overcome all kinds of gaps in their lives. They needed food. They needed parental guidance. They needed role models and support. They needed food, clothing, school supplies. There was so much more that kids needed. And that teachers are having to fill those gaps.
I would think that one of the things that you would say is that the social media, the electronic media that is so ubiquitous today, that wasn't true 14 years ago. That must make a difference.
Definitely,
in terms of
yes.
teacher.
Absolutely. I mean, I teach with tools right now in my classroom that didn't exist 5 years ago. And in five more years, I will be teaching and working with things that don't exist right now. And so having to stay nimble about with that and on top of it, and being able to not be afraid of new technologies, to figure out how to use them and incorporate them into your classroom, and also not being afraid to harness the power of what kids already have. Almost every single kid at school comes in with some amazing portable learning device in their hands or around their necks or in their backpacks. And in the beginning, when we didn't know how to bring that into the classroom, you know, the first reactions were to just keep those turned off. And now we're realizing, why would you ever want to shut down the power of that portable world at your hand, at your fingertips? And so to try to figure out how to get what kids have, figure out what they have, how can we use it so that kids can learn and reach out into the world and become real world learners has been exciting to me. And I think to most good teachers, we're excited about using that technology.
But it isn't also a challenge. I mean, does it make the learning process different because they come with a different set of skills?
Absolutely, yes.
A different orientation to the world.
Absolutely, and it's in many ways more immediate, faster, they're more demanding. They want an authentic learning experience. They want it quickly, they want it right now. And the challenge for teachers today is to try to keep up with that. I mean, it's like a puppy who's you've taken out for a walk and the leash has gotten away from you. They take off, and it's up to you to catch back up and grab that puppy and make sure they're safe. You know, the technology will always race ahead of us. We're seeing that right now. And it's not up to good teachers to stand still and cross your arms and say, come back to me where I'm at. It's incumbent on us to kind of catch up, figure out how it works, partner with kids, and educate ourselves at the same time about how to wisely use that technology so that learning can occur. Not all technology is a good use of our time in the classroom, but a lot of it sure is.
Uh-huh. But what about what it does to students' intellectual ability to learn? I'm thinking about you teach English, for mm-hmm. instance, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and the social media doesn't use standard English. Does that get in your way?
Well, I think what you do, I use the analogy of learning to ride a bike or even skateboard. You have to know how to do it, the essentials of it first, before you can start doing tricks and cut corners and make shortcuts and do something really snazzy. And so I tell them, when we're communicating, I need you to learn how to communicate perfectly first. And then in these different environments and arenas where you are communicating, I want you to tailor your words, your attitude, your tone to that world, that universe. So if it's you and I speaking, I'd like you to use correct grammar and proper sentence structures. If you're online tweeting, you're going to have to abbreviate and use acronyms. If you're on Facebook, you know, there are different arenas that we're all communicating in, and there are different rules for each one. That's our reality. And so I'm teaching kids how to survive in all of those places.
And is survival as likely today as it was 14 years ago?
Survival in the communication arenas?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. If anything, it's harder for them. You know, you and I had one thing to learn,
yes.
and then we could get creative. It was called creative writing, and we could take a liberty here or there with the way we wrote or spoke or punctuated. But now kids have to learn how to navigate Facebook and Twitter and MySpace and mom and dad and the classroom and the workplace. They have to know how to network in all of those areas. And so I think they have it harder, and thus their teachers have it harder.
When you teach English, what is the form in which you teach them to communicate? Is it the essay still?
Everything. No. Reading, writing, listening, and speaking. There are four prongs to what I think most teachers are doing in the classroom. I have to teach kids how to read critically and appreciate the written word. I have to teach them how to write in different genres and for different purposes, for different audiences. So they have to know how to write that five-paragraph essay, that classic old classroom standby. I have to teach them how to compose memos, emails, letters, tweets. I have to teach them how to ace a job interview. I have to teach them how to give a speech. I have to teach them how to listen carefully to politicians' arguments so they can really hear what's being said to them and make judgments about what they're hearing and how to act on those judgments. There are so many different ways that I'm asking kids to communicate back to me what they've learned.
And that's part of the English classroom?
Oh, yeah. It's all, everything. We are singing, we're dancing, we're doing math in the classroom, we are building things and breaking it down, and the whole while we're reading about it, we're talking about it, we're writing about it. Kids are reading and writing a lot more, even now, than when I first started teaching. That's what's been great about the world speeding up the way it seems to have, is that now kids are expected, you have to type and write to get out there in this world today. And maybe 10 years ago, you didn't have to.
When I learned to touch type when I was about 13 years old, only because my father did. My father was a writer. And I was a freak. There was nobody in my high school that knew how to touch type.
Right.
And now they all do.
They all do. Yeah, they're teaching us. That's the thing is, it's the world has spun around quite quickly, and now they're in a position to be teachers themselves.
That's Rebecca Milwaukee, last year's National Teacher of the Year, who spoke with us on issues and ideas in the spring. We went on to talk with her about the morale of teachers today. She had this to say.
I know it'll be shocking to say this or to even hear it, but, you know, sometimes I feel like I've been left holding the bag because teachers certainly have been blamed for almost all of public school failure. And I feel like, well, hold on a minute. You put me into a system that's not fully funded. You send to me kids who are experiencing challenges in their lives at home that are unprecedented in this economy. And it's that lack of leadership, that lack of money, and those challenges at home that make my job so incredibly difficult that when I do have a success, it's a miracle. And I'm so proud of it. And I protect it with my life. And so then to be kicked around as a teacher in the media and by other people, it's really a heartbreak. It's a heartbreak. But it doesn't get me down. I'm going to keep working hard. I come to work with a smile every day. There's just so much work to do and so many kids' lives to improve. And education does do that.
Rebecca Milwaukee, last year's National Teacher of the Year from Burbank, California. We talked a bit about her approaches to teaching in our technology-mad world.
So if you were to enter a classroom today, it would not look like the classrooms of our day. You would see a hive of activity. You would have a hard time finding the teacher because they would be among the kids. And what you would see would be teams of kids working together to solve interesting challenges or problems or creating products in the classroom. It's a world that I hope allows both boys and girls to thrive.
In some of the material that you sent out, you had some advice to new teachers. I think there were 9 items in it. Mm. Some of them seemed to me to be fairly obvious, but a few others I thought were interesting, and I wanted to ask you about
yes.
some of those. You probably wrote that a long time ago and may not even remember what's on it, but let's take a chance. And the second one, it's all about the pencil.
Oh, right. Yes.
Now, what did you mean by that?
Well, when you're a new teacher, you have this real zealous sense that your job is to not just teach your content, but also to teach responsibility. It's a big, big deal to you when you're a young teacher. And so you end up fighting battles over the homework. Where is it? Why don't you have it? The handout, where is it? I gave it to you. You lost it. I'm not giving you another one. Or kids turn up without books or pencils, or they're missing something that's so essential to your class going forward. And when you're a new teacher, you end up sort of fighting that battle to try to teach children responsibility, and you'll end up making decisions that actually don't help that child or you go forward. You will not give them a pencil if they don't have one, or force them to go find one somewhere else, or you refuse to give them another handout because it's the third one they've lost from you, and when are they going to finally wise up and get responsible? And you end up fighting all these battles for the purpose of teaching them responsibility, but it doesn't end up advancing your instruction or their learning. Saw a teacher and was mentored by a teacher who said, you need to swat away any and all distractions. Think of yourself as the quarterback carrying the ball into the end zone. Let nothing stand in your way between you and those kids and what you need to accomplish each day. It can't be a pencil. It can't be a handout. It can't be a call slip or an announcement over the speaker. You have to keep going. The world will teach kids responsibility. When you go into workplaces, everybody's got their car keys and their phones and they've got pants on. The world will teach them to show up with what they need. So have faith that that will happen. But in your class, you're the only person that can deliver English instruction to those kids. And you've got 52 minutes to do it. Don't waste your time on the pencil.
But teacher Rebecca Milwaukee was passing through the area and visiting with area teachers when she visited with us on issues and ideas. It turns out she has a special connection locally.
Proud Mustang. Absolutely. Yes. I graduated in 1990 with a speech communication major. My father went to Cal Poly to get his master's degree in counseling, and he himself, after a career in the Army, went to become a high school counselor and teacher. And he was determined that one of his three daughters would come to Cal Poly, and he would drive us down here every summer to see the campus. And I was the last of the Mohicans, the last daughter, and saw campus and saw how beautiful it was. And I think there might have been a cute boy or two that I spotted out the car window. And I said, yep, that's the school for me. And I loved every minute of my time here. I met my husband at KCPR at the radio station. The minute I laid eyes on him, I knew he was the one for me. And that was 25 years ago. We're still together.
That was last year's Teacher of the Year, Rebecca Milwaukee, who spoke with us on Issues and Ideas last March. When we come back, we'll visit and revisit a few of the people who we talked to this year doing interesting and useful things in the community. One's a ranger, and two are impresarios, one of the performing arts and the other of food. This is Issues and Ideas.
And this is KCBX. Support for KCBX is provided by the listeners and also by UCSB Arts and Lectures, presenting the San Francisco Jazz Collective in their 10th anniversary tour at UCSB Campbell Hall. It will be Thursday evening, October 17th at 8 o'clock. Tickets are available at 893-3535. We are in our fall pledge drive, asking you to pledge your support for programs like Issues and Ideas by calling 549-8855. Joining us are Katherine Johnson and Paul Sievertson.
Hey, Brian. I came running in because I was standing in the kitchen listening to that Teacher of the Year. That was an interview that I remember Larry doing and I had wanted to hear. She seemed like such a dynamic person, and I had not heard that connection to San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, it doesn't help to work at KCBX. You're always busy, so you never get to listen
exactly. to the radio. Everybody's always asking me, did you hear? And I'll say, well, 30 seconds of it or 2 minutes of it.
Larry's been doing a wonderful job talking to movers and shakers and people of real interest from inside and outside the community and connected some way to the Central Coast. Issues and Ideas, Larry's just one of the talented interviewers that we have working mostly as volunteers. And we need to hear from you that you support this kind of programming. It's something that we want to continue to develop, more local presence, because there are lots of great stories here. And there are lots of news events that we need to cover and issues in the community that need a lot of exposure. So what you're doing when you make a pledge of support is supporting that kind of programming. The infrastructure, the people, the wherewithal to get it out on the air and on the internet and keep the discussion going. That's what you do when you call 549-8855 with a pledge of support.
And you support the idea of a community radio station, because there are so many connections and interconnections in our community, and we have so many loyal volunteers here at the station. I was listening to Neil earlier talking about how he sometimes learns about new music through listeners that bring music into him, and then he learns something new and then shares that with his listening audience. And so there's a real relationship. And if you visit the station at 4100 Vachel Lane in San Luis Obispo, you get a feel for that. Because you see that there are people here answering the phones on their own time. You see that there are businesses like Novo delivering delicious food. You see that there's a premium board full of premium cards from local businesses that are doing their part to support community radio. So now we're asking you to do your part. Dial 549-8855 and make your contribution at any level, whatever you can afford, to support KCBX going strong. And we're in our 38th year?
38th year,
38th
yes.
year.
Yes. Going on 39th. Yes, and we want to keep that tradition going strong, and we can do that with your help right now. Make that $52 pledge and ask for the food bank premium, and that will provide help the food banks provide 20 meals to families in need.
Yeah, that's at the $52 level, and it goes on up from there. If you contribute $100 to KCBX, that provides 40 meals. $240 provides 100 meals, and so on. So it's a really great way to do two good deeds with one phone call or one visit to kcbx.org.
Call now, 549-8855, toll-free 1-800-549-8855, or you can make your pledge on the web at kcbx.org. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being with Krista Tippett, but right now, let's get back to issues and ideas here on Public Radio KCBX.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Larry Rutter. This week, we're having fun revisiting some of the more interesting people and projects we encountered on the program this year. In a minute, we'll revisit talks I had with two impresarios, one of the arts and the other of food. But first, national parks are among my favorite places, even though they've been closed during the government shutdown. However, earlier this year, one of the least known wilderness areas of this state was about to be upgraded from a national monument to a national park. That's pretty rare, and it's an important event for the local area. I'm talking about the Pinnacles, located close by in southern Monterey County. So I called up the park superintendent, Karen Bippler-Dorn, and asked her about the park and its future. But what mostly I wanted listeners to know is what a gorgeous place is hidden in these Pinnacles as you pass by them on Highway 101. So I asked Superintendent Bippler-Dorn to give us a verbal description of the park in our backyard.
As part of that mountain range, it's got a unique place in that Pinnacles is a little piece of a volcanic system. And that volcanic system that formed millions of years ago, half of it traveled along the San Andreas Fault to the location of Pinnacles, where it is now, and eroded away and has made these magnificent spires of rock that you can see when you hike in the park. And the other half is 200 miles to the south and is just basically rolling California hills. So there's a very unique volcanic geologic system that you can view here at the park. And because of that, we have a lovely oak savanna chaparral ecosystem. And many, many people love to come here in the spring to see the beautiful wildflower displays that are present, and also migrating birds in the spring and fall.
What would be, if we went there, kind of our biggest surprise?
It provides a sense of adventure. There's these lovely canyons up into the hills that you can follow along stream courses, and at least some of them run with water even in the hottest parts of summer. And they cascade down, one of them cascades down through the Bear Gulch Caves, and that's a great experience to walk through the caves. And it's dark, and you have to wear a headlamp, and you hear water cascading through, and then you emerge out into the beautiful Pinnacles spires and the amazing landscape that you can see here.
Karen, are there any exotic wildlife, things that might surprise us, nestled in between these rocks and caves and lakes and whatnot?
Well, Pinnacles, of course, is one of three release sites for the endangered California condor here in the United States. And so at certain times of year, for sure, you can definitely see condors free flying over the Pinnacles. And there's only about 300 condors in existence today, and 200 are in the wild. So having the chance to see some California condors free flying in the skies over the Pinnacles is just an exciting experience.
Hey, what do you think is the greatest environmental threat to the park right now?
National parks are small slices out of the area, small pieces of open land out of the areas where they exist. And one of the key things that we look towards doing is working with park neighbors and communities and other land managers on protecting the habitats that surround the park. Since we're just a little piece of the area, we need to work closely with our local communities, counties, local government, private landowners, all in a cooperative way to manage lands to protect the valuable natural and cultural resources of the area where we exist. So we try to do that in a cooperative fashion.
And that was Superintendent Karen Bippler-Dorn of what is now officially the newest national park, the Pinnacles in southern Monterey County. I talked with her in January, just before the Pinnacles went from a monument to national park status. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Larry Rutter. We're using this occasion to relive some of the more memorable moments on Issues and Ideas that I hosted this year. Now we're going to revisit some people whose jobs are a lot different than being park rangers. They're impresarios, I call them, one of food and the other of the performing arts. We'll be talking about food in a minute. Running Cal Poly Arts, a major user of the Performing Arts Center, is no easy task, we learned when we talked to its head, Steve Lirian. He talked with us about how he's constantly juggling a lot of things, facilities and talent availability, financial exigencies, and some major egos. And then I asked him about one of the most memorable moments that he'd experienced working at Cal Poly Arts.
Well, there have been a number, but, being an old guy from the 60s, 60s and 70s, we also get to do some pop music, rock music. Last year, we partnered and brought Crosby, Stills, and Nash to the Performing Arts Center, and that was, they were and still probably are my favorite band of all time. So that has to be right up there in the highlights. Also, presenting Bill Cosby was quite a thrill for me. And on a personal level, I got to hang out with Bill for just he and I backstage for probably an hour and a half between shows, which was really fun.
Wow.
And in fact, I went up, and if you've been to the Performing Arts Center, you've seen I get up there pretty much every time and do some curtain speech, thank the sponsors, introduce the artists, etc. He came out on stage and surprised me while I was out there, and we did a 5-minute dog and pony show where he was talking to me about how much he loves jazz, and we were about to go into a jazz series, right, or sort of a little jazz festival right after that. So doing a dialogue with Bill Cosby on stage was definitely a career highlight for me.
All right, what's the low light?
Well, we've had some shows that, didn't meet my expectations, let's say. And I'm not going to go into into names.
Oh, come on.
Oh, no.
It's just you and I talking.
Well, we've had a dance program last spring that, let's just say that it wasn't what I expected. And we had a lot of people walk out. We had, I was embarrassed, to a large extent. And, it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't what we advertised because we didn't understand what they were talking about. And the quality of the dance wasn't that great. So that was probably the low light for me.
Well, I suppose one of the problems is that sometimes you buy a pig in a poke.
Uh-huh.
You think what you're getting, but you don't have any direct experience of it, and
right.
You take a chance on it.
Yeah, we do everything we can to see pretty much everything live before we present it, but that's obviously, problematic because, they may be a company from Nebraska, and getting there to see it is not easy. So fortunately, in our technological age here, we have the opportunity to see full full performances of the work typically, but other times not so much. And sometimes, you know, when you're booking something, when I'm booking a dance company, for example, the work that they're going to do 15 months later may not have anything to do with what I've seen them perform. So, you know, it's you run some risk, and it's, you know, it's a live performance world, and you can't, it's not like you can edit it.
Steve Larian, director of Cal Poly Arts, who we talked with earlier this year on Issues and Ideas. We're revisiting some of the year's more memorable editions of Issues and Ideas that I've hosted. I'm Larry Rutter. Coming up, we're going to talk to some very impressive and passionate people about the law. People we literally waylaid on the highway to come in to talk with us. Now, another impresario, this time of food. He's Peter Janke, who is head of the Slow County Farmers Market Association that runs five of the county's 20 certified farmers markets. We talked with him earlier this year. We began talking a little bit what I'd call the farmers market ethos or its importance in the community.
Okay, well, actually, I think a lot of times some people think about farmers markets, or they think about what they would get at a farmers market, or if farmers markets advertise, they always advertise the quality of their products, the diversity that they have, the probably more organic choices, and a variety of things about the vine ripened freshness, all of that kind of thing that we've talked about. But there's a huge different perspective that I don't think people really understand. Well, I think you do, because just before we started airing this, you began to sort of touch on that. And that is, it isn't like going to a grocery store and you go through and look for all of your things. You go to the farmer's market and it's part of your life. It's an experience. You meet people, you're talking with people, and in fact, there was an interesting just little tidbit here is that the Saturday morning farmer's market it was chosen by Chamber of Commerce to be one of the places for the Rand McNally judges to visit for San Luis's bid to the happiest city or the friendliest city. And so when the judges came out, and talking with them back and forth, I said, you know what? Just stop for a second and just listen. And all of a sudden, you can see a little smile coming out. There is this buzz of interactions between people, between farmers, between farmers and customers. It is a whole different dimension. It's really a part of where the community elements of the community come together. Mm-hmm. It's more than just going out and shopping for a peach or an apple. It's a great deal more than that. So we look at some of the different elements. So they're certainly the local farmers. And the Saturday morning one, they aren't coming just to look at sort of like and be awed by all the presentation. They're in their buying. So they're elements of their weekly shoppers. Then we have people like the fishermen. We have new people there. This is that the person who's selling the fish is representing them, Morro Bay fishermen. And so you can take out any fish that you look at, pick out of the bin. And so what you'll be, the woman selling it can tell you the name of the fisherman. The baker is local and bakes the bread. We also notice is that the number one agricultural crop in San Luis Obispo is wine grapes. And so we now have, we're fortunate to have the Slow Wine Country Association join us, and they're actually selling their wines twice a month at our Saturday morning farmer's market. So the reason for bringing all of that up is because it isn't just a farmer's market. It has so many elements of the community that come together to make this, shall we say, vibrant buzz.
Peter Janke of Slow Farmers Market Association, who we talked with earlier this year. We got a little insight from him in our talk about how farmers markets got started in California.
to be is that people would not be able to bring fruits and vegetables unless they were of a certain size, a certain texture, and the California Department of Food and Agriculture had very strict standards that had to be met, in part because you don't want to ship a whole bunch of oranges to New York and find out that a bunch of them were bad. So standards were set up, and the way farmers markets really started was the first Jerry Brown time, is that there was a real hardship for many of the small family farmers. So what was going on is that the brokers would pretty much control. The only way that people could sell their products was through brokers. And so one day is that they might make a killing, and the very next day they have to plow in under what they grew because it would have cost more money to try to harvest.
And that's true of farmers throughout the country, is that correct?
That's my understanding, yeah, sure. Probably true. And so because of the number of small family-operated farms that were beginning to dwindle, so the Jerry Brown administration developed the direct marketing concept. And that concept would be is that the farmer could sell directly to the consumer, which was a new thing, really, back in those days. And
we also talked with Peter Janke of the SLO County Farmers Market Association about the regulation of vendors at his farmers markets.
We view everybody in California as being local. So we do have probably 15, maybe 20% of our farmers that are outside of San Luis Obispo County. So, for example, in Fresno County and King County and the like. And these people have been with us probably for 30 years. And so we've, if you will, over the years, learned the things that we need to do to make sure that this meets our standard, and our minimum standard is indeed that the person who's selling that product actually is the one that grows it. So they can send employees, but it still has to be of their own production. We have gone on inspections, and if there's a red flag that comes up from one reason or another, then we will very vigorously pursue it. And we've had to, in the past, kick people out, but not for many years because we've earned the reputation. You don't mess with our farmers markets here.
That was from a conversation we had earlier this year with Peter Janke of SLO Farmers Market Association. Incidentally, just a month ago, the association celebrated its 25th anniversary. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter. Coming up, a chat we had with some people we contacted as they walked through the county.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX, where we're asking for your support by calling 549-8855. Joining us from Pledge Central are Catherine Johnson and Paul Sievertson.
And you heard Larry talking to people in our community about our community. Today is a real community day because we're emphasizing as a possible thank you gift for your gift today, the food bank premium. And the way that works is instead of us spending money on an item to send to you and spend the postage on and all of that, you can ask that money instead be sent to the food bank in your county. And that money is very effectively put to work by the food banks because what they do is have a whole network of neighborhood organizations, agencies that are able to collect and distribute the food to families who need help. And believe me, the help is needed. It's estimated that 1 in 6 families in our county are in need of help with their basic sustenance, getting good food on their table. And that's an alarming statistic to think about when we're in such a wealthy area. There's so much good life here. And it's also a blessing that we have so much access to good, fresh produce and that we have that there are programs like the GLEAN program, GLEAN SLO, where they're able to go into harvested fields and get more produce out of them and distribute it to food challenged families in the community. Well, you can help this whole endeavor. By making a pledge to KCBX, most of your money stays here in support of the programming, but a portion of it goes to the food bank to do their work. 549-8855 to make that contribution today.
Some interesting statistics we have here, Paul. Interesting and shocking, some of these statistics. In Santa Barbara County, last year alone, the food bank distributed more than 8.5 million meals, it says, of which fully half were fresh, nutritious produce. And 44% of those served by the food bank in Santa Barbara County are under the age of 18. Sometimes people need help because they've been laid off from a job or have had a medical emergency or are just struggling to meet basic household expenses. So trying to decide whether to pay the rent or buy nutritious food. So you can make an investment today that not only helps to pay for the programming here and the operations bills here at KCBX, but also to provide meals for local families in need. It is an investment that will pay off right away. You will continue to receive the high-quality programs that you appreciate on KCBX, and you also will know that you're doing your part to help feed hungry families in our communities.
I'd like to welcome Connie and Norm in San Luis Obispo, the most recent new subscribers to KCBX, first time donating this afternoon. And another one, Terrence Jones of Paso Robles, first time donors both, and we welcome them, welcome their support, and we're asking that you join in with your support now at 549-8855.
Toll-free 1-800-549-8855 or on the web at kcbx.org. This Thursday night at 6:30, be sure to listen for Willie Nelson to All the Girls. It's a one-hour special about Willie Nelson's latest project, a recording of duets with America's top women singers. You'll hear lots of music from the album and conversations with his duet partners like Dolly Parton, Nora Jones, Emmylou Harris, and many others. That's Willie Nelson to All the Girls this Thursday evening at 6:30 here on listener-supported KCBX. Let's get back to issues and ideas.
One of the most amazing group of visitors we had in our studio this year were found literally walking along the highway. They were representatives of the California Innocence Project on a mission to Sacramento to petition the governor about 10 cases of people they believe were imprisoned and innocent and in need of the governor's personal attention. The Innocence Project is based at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Speaking with us were the head of the project, Justin Brooks, and a staff attorney, Lisa Biracle. We asked Justin Brooks to describe the project.
And we're devoted to getting innocent people out of prison. So it's a very simple concept. Inmates and their family members write to us. We investigate every case that we receive into our office, and we use law students, lawyers, and law professors to investigate the cases. And if we find strong evidence of innocence, we go to court, get those cases reopened, and hopefully get those people home to their families.
Now, Barry Scheck has a New York-based version of this, and he's probably had the more national exposure. But I guess it's not uncommon on a state basis to have an Innocence Project.
Yeah, we now have 50-some projects in the United States, and we have projects around the world. The most recent project is a project that we started in Mexico at UABC Law School in Tijuana. So we actually run a project out of the law school down there. The network of projects all work together. We have a board that oversees all the projects. I sit on that board along with Barry Scheck. Mm-hmm. And this has become an international movement. And it's because it's very simple, and I think it's apolitical in the sense of we can all agree that innocent people shouldn't be in prison.
We asked Justin Brooks of the California Innocence Project why they believe what they were doing was so important.
Nothing could be more amazing than walking an innocent person out of prison. I've had the pleasure of doing that 10 times, and you get to give people their lives back. It's also amazing training for young lawyers. So we have every year a group of law students that we train to be lawyers while they're working on real cases. And the idea is to train them the way we train doctors. You know, doctors aren't just sent out to practice without ever working with human beings.
Interns.
So we take them, they kind of deconstruct the cases, figure out what went wrong, and then we piece them back together.
The Innocence Project had one particularly salient example of their successes, which they shared with us.
We represented a kid last year called Brian Banks, and he just got signed by the Atlanta Falcons as a linebacker. And his was a huge news story, and it brought a lot of attention to our cause. And Alyssa here actually worked on that case.
Melissa Biracle is a staff attorney. Tell us about that case.
The Brian Banks case was a case that came to us the same way a lot of cases come to us, through the person writing and saying, "I'm innocent." And, you know, we take a look at every single one of these cases, and in Brian's case, not only did he say he was innocent, but he had evidence that the victim had admitted that she lied and had admitted that on video. So he came to us with this information. We launched an investigation into it, and just every corner we turned, we just kept finding more evidence of innocence. Contacted the DA's office. They went in on the investigation with us, and together we were able to get his conviction reversed.
DNA play a role in that?
Not in the exoneration, it did not. Mm-hmm. There was some DNA testing done at the time of trial. It was a alleged rape where she said that there would have been semen, and there was DNA testing done at the time, and none was ever found. But regardless, because the prosecution had charged him with a lot of different crimes, he was facing a life sentence. And so he ended up taking a plea deal just to avoid that, even though he was innocent.
And this is California with the three strikes law. You can't afford a third strike.
Yeah.
Well, he had no strikes. You know, he was a high school kid, but he was facing 40-some years in prison. And his lawyer said, you know, we can go in there and roll the dice and go to trial, but she's going to come in and say you raped her and that you kidnapped her. And so he's sitting there, a 17-year-old kid, having to make the decision between going to trial and risking 40-some years in prison or taking a deal that could lead possibly to probation, but in worst-case scenario, a couple of years in prison. So he took that deal and actually went to prison for 5 years.
Wow.
But when he got out, she Facebook friend requested him, said, "Can we let bygones be bygones," and admitted that it never happened.
That was from our conversation in May with representatives of the California Innocence Project. They were walking through the area on their way to Sacramento to petition the governor. We talk with its head, Justin Brooks, about some of the underlying causes of wrongful convictions.
It's the leading cause of wrongful conviction. There was a study done of the 2,000 documented cases of wrongful convictions in the United States. And that study had some surprising results. One of them was that bad identifications are the leading cause of wrongful convictions. We also learned that in a high percentage of those cases, snitch testimony was used to get convictions, and that there was a lot of cases where there were actually confessions, but ultimately later on it was discovered the people were innocent. And so we learned that sometimes, you know, people confess to crimes they haven't committed.
Why do you think they do that?
You know, I used to think it was because police were using tactics that were very aggressive to get these confessions. And, you know, quite frankly, I used to be much more cynical about the idea that people did confess to crimes they didn't do. But when you start reading the transcripts of some of these confessions, you see that people just get frustrated with the process. And after several hours, it's not because they're broken down with the baton or the hot light. They just want to get out of the room. So they'll say things like, "Just give me the paper and I'll sign it." Mm-hmm. And they're thinking, what difference does it make if they sign a confession? Because they didn't do it. And that'll later on be proven out. Next thing you know, maybe there's a bad identification. Maybe there's a jailhouse snitch. Maybe they don't have an airtight alibi and they get convicted.
A walking trip from San Diego to Sacramento. I got to ask you about that walking trip. Why?
Well, it's a crazy idea I had about a year ago. You know, we win a lot of cases, we get a lot of people home, but there's a lot of cases we don't win. And we never give up a case. Because if we believe someone's innocent, we will keep fighting for them year in, year out, in as many venues as we can. And the governor has clemency power. He can fix these cases if he chooses to do so. But clemency is often used for wealthy or well-connected people. our clients are poor. People don't know about their cases. So I decided that I was going to walk from San Diego to Sacramento and carry the petitions with me on thumb drives and deliver them personally to the governor. And Alyssa Bierkall and Mike Szymanczyk, two of my staff attorneys, as soon as I mentioned it to them, they said, yeah, let's do it. We'll all do it together. So we've been walking now for 26 days, is it, Alyssa?
It's 26.
This is our 26th day walking from San Diego. And it's been difficult. We've been walking on highways, dodging traffic. We've had to weave our way up the coast in places where it's almost impossible to walk. But we've been raising awareness and doing shows like this one to talk to the public about this issue.
And you're taking how many cases up to the governor?
We have 12 cases that we've identified where there's compelling evidence of innocence. In fact, in a couple of these cases, judges have found these people innocent, and yet they're still sitting in prison on technicalities. And I think that's something the public doesn't realize, that you can actually be found innocent and still be in prison on procedural reasons, like not filing your paperwork on time. And it's pretty shocking that in a system that, first of all, is overcrowded and expensive, that we would have any interest in keeping innocent people in prison just to uphold procedures.
I asked Justin Brooks of the California Innocence Project if somehow the legal system in California was flawed.
For me, coming here, you know, 13 years ago, and we travel around the state in all the jurisdictions practicing, there clearly is blue California and red California. I find more and more resistance the further we get from the ocean. I don't know.
Well, having spent 20 years up in red California, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's a different world.
Alyssa's from Truckee, so she's from the mountain regions of California. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think the legal system is really one of the more conservative ones. I mean, if you could just look at our prison population, we have the largest prison population per capita in the nation, not even just the nation, but in the world. If California was its own country, we have more people in prison per capita than anyone else. Not only that, but we have the harshest sentencing laws of any state. We really do. We like to lock people up and throw away the key, and that's what we're doing here.
Because of the three strikes law, or just generally?
We have three strikes. We have the death penalty. It's hard to look and find a system that's more severe than ours in terms of sentencing. And then it's so overcrowded, as Alyssa said, it's such a huge system that mistakes get made, because it's become kind of like a factory where plea bargains are 95% of the cases. And so mistakes get made. If you're in a smaller jurisdiction, a smaller state, more attention can be paid to cases.
I then talk with Justin Brooks and Lisa Bierkall about how they go about their work.
We get 1,500 to 2,000 requests a year for assistance.
Wow.
And we investigate every one of those cases, meaning we at least look at the trial record, call the appellate attorneys who've worked on the case, call the trial attorneys, and we're able to do that because we use law students, by and large, to do the investigations. There's about 50 cases a year that get into a full-blown investigation where we believe there's a possibility, a real possibility of gathering the evidence we're going to need. And we might file on 5 cases a year that ultimately to go to hearing. And a good year, we get 1 or 2 people out of prison. So it goes from, you know, 2,000 down to 2. And so the bulk of the work is screening through those cases. Now, there are many more innocent people than that in prison. It's just the standards are so high for us to prove innocence. We know in the overwhelming majority of cases, we'll never be able to prove it.
And finally, I asked Justin Brooks about any changes he would make in how the police and courts go about their work to avoid as much as possible wrongful convictions.
Tomorrow, we could change identification procedures. Simple things like the investigating officer who knows who the suspect is should not be in the room when an ID is done. Poker players are the best people in our society at hiding what they think. And still, they wear hats, they wear scarves, they wear mirror glasses, they try not to talk when they're playing poker. Police officers are not great poker players, and they often indicate who the suspect is during the procedure. And study after study has shown this. And just by simply excluding those officers from those procedures, we could improve IDs. So there's a lot of simple things like that.
Give me another example. That's fascinating.
We should be audio taping and videotaping interrogations. I mean, if we're confident...
And we don't?
No. There's no requirement for that. Mm-hmm. And if we're confident that these things are done right, then you'd think you'd want that recorded and documented. You'd want to show it and say, look, we offered him coffee, offered him tea, and he gave a confession. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that there's no cost associated with. So there's some that can be simply done without any cost. And there's other ones that we need to, you know, put some money into, like investigation and spending more time on that. We also need to have better evidence preservation. It costs a lot less to maintain evidence than it does to keep innocent people in prison. And with the majority of the cases we look at, the evidence has been thrown out. Hmm. That's a serious problem.
That was a conversation we had in May with Justin Brooks and Lisa Biracle of the California Innocence Project, part of a group of young law students and lawyers making their way on foot to Sacramento to petition the governor. To our knowledge, the governor has yet to act on any of their 10 petitions for clemency. And that is this week's edition of Issues and Ideas, a look back at some of the interesting people, ideas, and issues we've encountered. This is Public Radio KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter.
And the number to call for your pledge of support is 549-8855. Here to tell you more is Katherine Johnson and Paul Sievertson.
That's me. I'm a development director at KCBX. And Katherine handles the money.
That's right.
Yes. And so this is a very important part of the year for us. We come to you directly. We don't sit behind our desks. We don't hide. We come to the forefront where we don't necessarily belong by these microphones. We're not the most adept on air, but it's necessary for us to make the case for public radio, and this is the case. We don't sell commercial time. That means the money has to come from somewhere else. And what better place to receive your funding than from the people who actually use the service directly? Not through a middleman, not through a smokescreen, but asking you directly, have you done your part to support this programming that you tune into week after week? Have you thought about the fact that somebody is doing this? And if it's not you, then who is it? Your neighbor? You're counting on your neighbor to do this? You've gotten through many pledge drives, perhaps, and the radio has never gone away. KCBX has always been there. Well, you're taking a chance, folks, because somebody is stepping up to the plate, and we're asking you to be one of those to do it right now. Drown us in success today, 549-8855.
And today is a special day of our pledge drive because it is Food Bank Wednesday, the day that we are talking about our partnership with the Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara County Food Banks, who we've been partnering with for quite some time, very successfully. And interestingly, we are at the spot in the pledge drive where we need about $44,000.
Actually, I just did some calculations.
Oh, you did?
It's down to about $41,000.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's better.
Right. So another $1,000 and change, and we're below $40,000 left to raise. This is an exciting part of the drive because we're scheduled through Saturday with almost less than $40,000 to raise. We can do a big push right now.
Wow, that would be fantastic. And we could do that with your help, calling 549-8855. And if you make your pledge right now, you can ask for the food bank premium at the $52 level or above, and a portion of your pledge will be redirected to help provide support for food distribution at the food bank in the community in which you live.
549-8855, toll-free 1-800-549-8855. We are just about to get into On Being with Krista Tippett. It's a conversation about the big questions at the center of human life, from the boldest new science of the human brain to the most ancient traditions of human spirit. Paul Sievertson?
Yes, I wanted to add something. That Charlie Blair is a real fan of this show, and he likes to do challenges, and he